Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two segments today. Imminently, we'll hear from the economist William Darity, also known as Sandy, on the vast gaps between black and white wealth. Then at the bottom of the hour, the Portuguese labor historian Raquel Varela will talk about the recent election in her country and the ongoing politics of debt and austerity. First, William Sandy Darity. Darity is an economist who is professor of public policy at Duke University. He's written widely on race and inequality, often in collaboration with Derek Hamilton of the New School. Several of their recent papers have looked at the enormous wealth gap between blacks and whites in the United States. Most people who analyze inequality look at income gaps, but wealth gaps are also important and are much, much larger. The two concepts are often confused, but the distinction is important. In economic jargon, income is a flow, that is, what you make in a year, and wealth is a stock, what you've got in the bank, less the debts you owe. Here's Sandy Darity to talk about the racial wealth gap and why it matters. Welcome back, Sandy Darity. So, wealth, why is wealth important?
Wealth is important because it's a source of security for families and households, particularly when they're confronted with emergencies or unexpected losses in income. This could include a situation where a family member who has been a contributor to the family's resources loses a job, or if there's a major or catastrophic illness in the family. All of these are factors that could contribute to an instability in a family's resources and perhaps plunge them into deprivation. I think my colleague Anirudh Krishna at Duke says that the major factor that pushes families into poverty worldwide is a major medical emergency. So that's the first reason it provides security. The second is it provides opportunity. That is to say, it provides opportunity to participate fully in this society, both economically and politically. In the context of economic participation, having an initial level of wealth or net worth allows you to start up your own business. It enhances your opportunity for purchasing higher education or a higher quality elite private education at the high school level, or it enables a family to move into an elite neighborhood where there might be a high quality public school. So I think at the cornerstone of it all, wealth is the key dimension in terms of determining people's capacities to survive and thrive in American society.
Which can be a very brutal thing. Now, I hope I'm not assuming too much, but I suppose most audience members know that there's a large disparity in incomes between black households and white households, and also Hispanic households and white households. But the disparities in wealth are even greater, correct?
Yes. The disparities in wealth are actually staggering. So if we said roughly that the typical or median black or Latino household had about 65 to 70% of the income of the median white household, those numbers look dramatically different when we start looking at wealth or net worth. So as of 2013 or so, the median white household in the United States would have about $120,000 in wealth or net worth, in contrast with the median black household having closer to $5,000, or the median Latino household having closer to $6,000 or so. So as of 2013, for every 1 cent in net worth that black or Latino households had, white households had 12 to 13 cents.
That's a really remarkable disparity, even for someone used to the inequality of the American income distribution.
Yeah, so the wealth distribution, as you've noted, is even more skewed than the income distribution, far more so.
Now, to some degree, that reflects the difference in income distribution, but there are other reasons for this enormous disparity as well. Let's go through some of those reasons. But before we do, though, that white wealth figure, that includes the principal residence for homeowners, right?
Certainly it does, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the equity associated with it.
Right. Net worth being assets less debts for the audience's edification.
So I guess the important dimension here is that for most white households, the positive effects of the equity value of their homes exceeds the ongoing debt that's associated with meeting mortgage payments. That's not necessarily the case for Black or Latino households.
And then what is the racial ethnic disparity in homeownership?
So let me see if I can get this correct in my mind. I think among whites, it's approximately 70% of whites own homes, and it's less than 50% for blacks and Latinos at the moment. Now, there is some decline in home ownership across all groups in the midst of the Great Recession, but the decline was sharper among blacks and Latinos.
And, parenthetically, the enormous retrenchment in housing wealth during the Great Recession hit black families much harder than white. That's correct?
Yes, I think, but black families didn't have much wealth before the Great Recession started. So I mentioned a figure of 1 cent of black median wealth for every 12 to 13 cents of white median wealth. That ratio was probably closer to 1 cent per 10 cent in 2005, before the Great Recession. So there was a huge disparity then. The conditions of the Great Recession just made the situation worse in terms of wealth inequality.
Okay, so now let's review some of the reasons for this disparity. And income certainly is part of it, but even if you take a black and a white household at the same income level, there will still be a wealth disparity, correct?
Yeah, there'll be huge disparities. One way we've attempted to look at this is to think about categorizing income in quintiles. So we rank income recipients in 20% lots. And so we can go from the highest quintile to the lowest quintile and look at the ratio of wealth between blacks and whites in each of these quintiles. And if we're looking at the highest quintile, median wealth ratios are about 40% between blacks and whites. And the ratio declines as you move down the income scale. So that when you get to the lowest quintile, the folks who are receiving the lowest incomes in American society, median black wealth is about zero, and it's about $15,000 for whites. So we can't really explain these wealth gaps on the basis of associated changes or variations in income.
And just to make it clear, this has nothing to do with any kind of moral turpitude in the black population.
Well, no, not at all. In fact, if we think about the motivation to pursue education and the act of acquiring additional education as an indication of people's moral commitment to doing the right thing, we still find that if we try to compare blacks and whites with similar levels of education, that we have huge, huge wealth disparities still. And moreover, if we compare blacks with considerably more education than whites, we still have huge disparities. So I think the most striking and dramatic example is the fact that our most recent evidence indicates that blacks with a college degree have approximately $10,000 less in net worth than whites who never finished high school.
So some of the reasons for this, I assume we're talking generations of inheritance figure prominently.
Yeah, I would complement thinking about inheritance with something that we call, in the jargon, in vivo transfers. So inheritances are shifts in resources across generations that occur when the donor dies. But in vivo transfers are contributions that are made from one generation to the next while the donor is still living. And those are especially important, not necessarily because of their magnitude, but often because of their timing. when they occur in the course of a young person's development or life cycle. So, for example, if an individual's parents help them finance their college education, reducing the likelihood that they'll incur indebtedness in the process of being students, that's an in vivo transfer. We sometimes just call these things gifts, but we don't always identify every kind of contribution that parents might make to their offspring as a gift. And so so another example might be a kid graduates from high school and their graduation gift is an automobile. Well, that's an in vivo transfer. Or a young couple that's newly married sets out to purchase a home, and the parents of either member of the newlywed couple provides them with support in making a down payment on the home. That's an in vivo transfer. Something that occurs among more wealthy households is the provision of trust funds to their sons and daughters. And that's an in vivo transfer as well. So I would say it's a combination of inheritances and in vivo transfers, which set up some Americans for the opportunity to have a strong net worth position and preclude others from having a strong net worth position. So in my way of thinking, the key factor that determines the next generation's wealth position is the wealth position of their parents, or, you know, to put it in a more straightforward way, the best way to get rich is to have rich parents.
Yes, one must choose one's ancestors wisely, isn't it?
That's right.
Now, there's this disparity in vivo transfers. How much of that is because of the disparities in wealth, and how much because of the disparities in income? Is it just that there's not enough spare change to pass along?
Yeah, so, you know, the capacity of parents to provide their kids with more is generally going to be contingent on what the wealth position is of those parents, not necessarily their income level. So if we're talking about people who are at the professional levels that are highly paid, professional service occupations like investment bankers and the like, they simultaneously have very high incomes with high net worth positions. And so it becomes somewhat difficult to sort out whether or not they're financing their kids' education through their income or their wealth. But households that are closer to the middle of the income distribution, their capacity to finance a child's higher education is really going to be closely tied to what their wealth position is.
I'm speaking with William Sandy Darity, who's a professor of economics at Duke. And I think I read in one of your papers that black families are more likely to give assistance to their children at the same income levels than white ones, right? It's not like they're being cheap.
No, it's actually... This was perhaps one of the most surprising findings in the work that we've done, which is the following, that black parents who give resources to their children to pursue higher education have about one-third of the median net worth of white parents who do not. So if we're thinking of two pools of people, a group of black folks who are giving their kids some resources for higher education, and a group of white parents who are not giving their kids any resources for higher education, the white parents have a considerably stronger wealth position than the black parents. And so I think that's somewhat indicative of a general tendency on the part of blacks to pursue higher education. We know that if you take into account the socioeconomic status of black and white families, that once you take that into account, blacks will generally get more years of schooling and more credentials than whites. I think that's partially a consequence of the fact that generally for black Americans, education is the only potential avenue for social mobility. We don't usually have a situation where you can move into the family business or, you know, work for your parents in a direct way. So this may explain why blacks actually display a greater commitment to the pursuit of higher education.
Yeah, I once heard Patrick Mason give a paper where he cited some research showing that the best predictor of educational attainment of children is the educational attainment of their parents. And with since the end of slavery, actually, black families, they consistently overshoot the predicted educational attainment.
Yeah, that's actually one of Patrick's most compelling papers. Yeah.
So over the last 50 years or so, we've certainly seen the entry of a lot of black individuals into the professions, into the upper and middle classes, in ways that we didn't see 50, 60 years ago. If we just let things take their natural course, will this wealth disparity erode over time?
So I would say no, because unlike the incomes that are associated with the movement to the middle class, there hasn't been an accompanying dramatic change in the wealth position of black households. And that's because the previous generation doesn't have the wealth to transfer. And education and income do not generate large fortunes of wealth. They might generate smaller ones, but they don't generate that much. So I think we're kind of wedded to this view that the way in which wealth is generated is through savings out of income. So if you have more education, you have more income, and you'll have more savings. But as I've suggested earlier, I'm absolutely convinced that the primary source of wealth is transfers across generations, not personal savings out of income. And so becoming a member of the middle class, if you're black, doesn't give you inheritances and in vivo transfers in and of itself. It just gives you a relatively higher income, but that's not going to contribute much to wealth accumulation.
So then what can we do about this disparity?
I've suggested two things. One is, given that it's a racial disparity that finds its origins in the history of this country's patterns of slavery and discrimination, the long century-long execution of Jim Crow policies and the like, that one solution is to introduce a program of reparations, which would actually provide black Americans potentially with a wealth foundation that they have long been denied. Another policy is one that would try to tackle wealth inequality across the entire American community, and that's a policy that Derek Hamilton and I have been calling the baby bonds proposal. We actually got that phrase from the late Manning Marable. And strictly speaking, it's not a bond. It's a trust fund or an endowment that would be given to each newborn infant. It would be provided by the government. It would not become accessible for each child until the individual reached adulthood, 18 years of age. The government would guarantee each of these accounts a 1% real rate of interest increase over the course of the 18 years before the kid could access it. And we would adjust the amount of the trust fund or endowment by the family's wealth position. So for those families at the highest end of the wealth distribution, a child born into those families would get, say, a $50 trust fund. But for children who are born into families at the lowest end of the wealth distribution, they would get a $50,000 to $60,000 trust fund. So in both cases, I'm thinking that, what we really have to do to address wealth inequality is to have some kind of mechanism for redistribution. Now, what's maybe critical here is that I think both of these policies do not require confiscation of wealth from others. I mean, you certainly could fund these or finance these by having some sort of reform in taxes that would draw more heavily on estates or might reduce the kinds of tax breaks that go to the rich, but you don't necessarily have to do it that way. So it is possible to have programs of redistribution without confiscation.
Now, I can just hear Rick Santelli fuming on CNBC. We're just going to give this money away? I mean, what do you say to somebody who snarls that way?
The answer is yes, but we're giving it away for a reason. We're giving it away because there has been an unfair and unjust process of depriving large communities in the United States of the opportunity to actually accumulate wealth.
Any sense of how much this would cost?
If we estimate that there are about 4 million newborn infants each year, and if the average trust fund was about $20,000, then the annual outlay would be about $80 billion for this program, which I guess is, you know, not really a huge share of the American national budget. But also, the first payouts would not have to occur until 18 years from the inauguration of the program. So there would be an opportunity to build up, we could actually build up a trust fund to fund the trust, in a sense, over that period of time. But, you know, the rough estimate is probably about $80 billion per annum would be the amount that would be required for the initial commitment to each cohort.
People throw around the term structural racism in a rather abstract way sometimes, but this strikes me as a really very material root of precisely that. It's this kind of wealth disparity is perpetuated over the generations and leads to the perpetuation of inequality.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if people want to put some meat on the notion of structural racism, if we address the problem of racial wealth inequality, then it stares us right in the face in a very concrete way.
Also, to American society, wealth is kind of a private sector substitute for what might be a reasonably decent program of social democracy. I mean, if we had better social benefits, wealth wouldn't be such a crucial thing, would it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we may want to look at societies like some of the Scandinavian countries that have these fairly well-developed social insurance programs and see whether or not there is the same reason to be as concerned about the wealth distribution there. But as long as we already have a system of inherited inequality associated with wealth, that could be perpetuated no matter how much we improve our system of social insurance. And so, I'm very concerned about that being something that's sustained or perpetuated indefinitely, and I think that still has to be addressed.
That was William Sandy Darity, a professor of public policy at Duke. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after some music. Some of the first of Georg Philipp Telemann's fantasies for solo flute, performed by Patrick Galois. Next, Raquel Varela, who teaches labor history at the New University of Lisbon. I first interviewed her when I visited Lisbon in December 2013. We talked about the politics of austerity in that country and the rest of the Europe periphery. Almost 2 years later, it's striking how little has changed. austerity goes on with surprisingly little protest. No doubt the crushing of Syriza's attempts at resistance in Greece have had their effect, or Syriza's capitulation, if you prefer. But the broad political tolerance of extended high unemployment and cuts in wages, earnings, and public services is striking. On October 4th, Portugal held a legislative election. The center-right alliance of two parties, known in English as Portugal Ahead, won 39% of the vote and 46% of the seats in Parliament, not enough to form a majority. The center-left Socialist Party, which despite its name was the initial author of the post-crisis austerity program, won 32% of the vote and 37% of the seats. Unusually, though, a coalition of three left parties took 10% of the vote and got 16% of the seats. So, were the Socialists to enter a coalition with that left bloc, they'd together have a parliamentary majority. Though a government has yet to be formed, the leftish coalition doesn't look to be happening. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, the right-wing columnist for the Daily Telegraph, the right-wing British newspaper, who, despite his cranky reactionary politics and weakness for conspiracy theories, has a following the English-speaking left, denounced this as a coup driven by EU austerity mandarins. That's not really what's happening. It's fairly standard politics and parliamentary systems. Here's Raquel Varela to explain. Portugal had an election with somewhat inconclusive results. So, first of all, could you tell us what the election results were?
Well, the elections are very interesting, the results, because the results, so the party that got the majority is the former, well, it's the coalition that was former in the government during the last austerity measures, during the last 4 years. But the majority of the parliament belongs to the Socialist Party, which is, I would not say a left party, but a third-way party, and the Communist Party and the left bloc. What has happened, in fact, is that the majority of the parliament is against the coalition that was forming the government, and I believe now there is a huge dispute over the control of the state resources, of course, and the left bloc and the Communist Party are willing to support, until now with very few conditions, government, austerity government led by the Socialist Party, that until now, what was, because the negotiations are officially secret negotiations, so they are not open, the negotiations of this so-called left government of these three parties. What is being said to the public is that neither the European treaties, neither the euro, neither the, even the renegotiation of the debt is in discussion. What seems to be in discussion is the not allowing cuts in the pensions and increasing social assistance.
Just to be clear for an American audience, the Socialist Party in Portugal is, well, you said third way, is a kind of a Blairite formation that is perfectly happy to administer austerity coming out of Brussels and Frankfurt, correct?
Yes, and they have started, in fact, the first austerity measures in Portugal. The first cuts in the salaries were done by this party, by the previous Prime Minister of the Socialist Party, José Sócrates, that was being persecuted or accused, not officially accused, but investigating a corruption process.
Brussels was rather alarmed by the election results, right? They really don't want to see any kind of government that is even vaguely anti-austerity formed, correct?
I think there is absolutely hysteria led by the media that has no real impact on reality. There are lots of Brussels leaders who have already said that are perfectly okay with a government led by the Socialist Party, with the support, either the parliamentary support or the government support, we don't know yet how it will be, by the left bloc or the Communist Party. So I think this hysteria that appeared in some media, the idea that will be communists in the government, like, well, first of all, there have been communists in governments in Europe in 20 different situations since the Second World War. And, of course, the Communist Party have been perfectly engaged with representative democracy regime and with a, let's say, in favor of a more regulated capitalism, but not questioning the capitalist accumulation or the private property or everything else. So I think there is a political hysteria, very propagandistic, very outside of reality, because the Communist Party and the Left Bloc, all the public speeches that have made until now was that they are willing to give up of part of their program in order to avoid a right-wing government, but they do not assume any cut with the public debt, even partially, or with the European institutions. They said exactly the opposite.
Tell us about this Left Bloc. It's a coalition of, three parties?
Well, the Left Bloc started to be something different from what it is now, because at the beginning was a coalition of communists that left the party after the Berlin Wall, let's say a new kind of Euro-communism, if we can call it like that, called Renovadores, Manifesto Group and others, former Trotskyist organization of the Fourth International. So the leader used to belong to that organization for a long time, Francisco Assin, the main leader of the Left Bloc until nowadays, and very more engaged in the labor movement and with some members in the unions of the UDP in the 70s was a Maoist group, in fact. Well, nowadays they still have a small party, but it's, let's say, well, a typical left-wing organization that was Maoist in the 70s and now is more pro-reform, although they keep a theoretical group around, I don't know exactly if it's still Maoist principles. So this is the leaderships of the party, but the Left Bloc itself is what I would say, they are not exactly new, as we can see. They have a lot of new generations as militants, or not exactly militants, but sympathizers, activists. But the main leaders, so the leaders that define strategically the party, they all come from the 70s. So they are all around 60 years old. And the strategy has been, if I can make a resume, honest resume, is that it's not possible in the conditions of Europe to have a revolutionary or a rupture movement. So we have to be in Euro, or we have to be together with the other left parties in Europe. They even were in the same European left organization of the European Parliament. So they would belong in the European sense to this broad organization that includes, that has included in the past, Refundación Comunista, the Green Red in Scandinavia, the Linke in Germany, and now the Syriza. They have strong connections with Syriza and Podemos. So I would say these kind of organizations that fight for... Nowadays, they really have a typical social democratic program of the 70s. So they are somehow they are the ones that have inherited the social pact in Europe. So the idea that capitalist accumulation has to live with good wages and protection of the labor market. Programmatically and in political action, that's what they represent nowadays.
And the Portuguese public, what's the attitude after all these years of austerity? The Left Bloc got 10% of the vote, which we assume is some kind of anti-austerity vote. But what's the broad consensus of the Portuguese public after all these years of being squeezed by Brussels and Frankfurt?
So we have a huge abstention rate. 43% of abstention rate, even after all these years of austerity measures. And we have the coalition of the government has lost 800,000 votes. And the left bloc has doubled, even more, a little bit more than doubled the votes. The Communist Party has increased very few, but has increased also. So what we have is really a vote anti-austerity, but I would say a vote that goes divided in two ways. In a way that the people that don't believe in the democratic liberal system, and they go to the abstention, which is a very critical vote, in my opinion, is not at all an abstention of people that are, let's say, outside the political system. What we see in the studies that were public, were published in Portugal about abstention is that abstention is correlated with the idea that there are no good public servants and that there are a lot of corruption, public services and corruption. And on the other way, we have a vote on anti-austerity parties, but that to have a very populistic speech towards the more, let's say, anti-rupture conscience of the average of the working class in Portugal. So the idea that there shouldn't be a rupture with the European Union, with the euro, with the debt, that has to be a way to go out of this crisis combining profits and salaries. So I think the average of the Portuguese, although they are questioning austerity, they do not want a rupture. And of course, these parties, in order to don't lose votes, they kept saying what is impossible, of course, because it's absolutely impossible to end with austerity measures and continuing to pay a debt that was 70% of the GDP in 2008. And after the banks were saved, it's 130% of the GDP. So nowadays, the biggest amount of money of the state is to pay debt. So the debt has become, there is a straight connection between surplus, bank system and state to remunerate capitals nowadays. So it's, I think it's absolutely impossible to do both. But I would say that the average of the Portuguese want a social pact, and that the left parties do not say the opposite in order to don't lose votes, or either because they really believe in that program. So we are in a very interesting situation.
I'm speaking with Raquel Varela, who is a labor historian at the New University of Lisbon.
But another thing that I wanted to point, which I think it's important to understand the situation, is that for us, historically, that we study political regimes in history, we were always taught, and we have learned that from the books and from the past, that the conciliation class governments would just appear in situation of social movements, social disruptions, strikes, protest of the working class. And we do not see this in Portugal. So we see the possibility of having a class collaboration government, but with no big social movement. We didn't have 15 general strikes as in Greece. There is not a situation as in France in the 36 with the Front Popular or whatever. We have a huge demobilization of the working class. So we have somehow the politics on the institutional level came much faster in crisis than the correspondence of a social movement that would go together with this political crisis. Do you understand my point?
Yes, that's a very important point. So why has there not been the kind of social mobilization that we saw, for example, in Greece?
Well, That's a very good question. In my opinion, we still have a very strong communist party that contributes to this, let's say, conciliation situation, and they lead still the most important unions. On the other way, we do have a huge crisis of the unions, all of them, including the ones leading by the communist party. Some have lost 40% of the members in the last 5 years, some of the biggest unions. So the unionization rate is 19%, officially is 90% in the public sector and 9% in the private, but this is not true nowadays. Could be 15 or 14 in the public sector and 6-7% in the private sector nowadays. And the working class feels absolutely desperate and
atomized.
Atomized, yes, thank you. They feel desperate. Their option has been highly migration. So it has been an individual and not a collective action option. It has been an individual way out, which the country has lost 500,000, which is 10% of the active population, of the employed population.
Where are people going?
Well, a majority to Europe, Angola, Brazil. So we do not see a social movement, but we see families. We see three generations living together at home again, another individual solution. Individual in the sense that is not collective action. We see migration, but we do not see people believing that collective action can help them. But we see this non-believing in the political system or questioning all the movements of the regime. We see this in the political level with a class conciliation government where nobody would expect this. To be absolutely honest, when I wrote this, my last book, I was expecting this class conciliation government. I wrote about it, but I didn't expect it was so soon. I didn't expect it would appear in the situation with no any kind of social disruption. And it did. So we have to think about why. The votes somehow express this better than the strikes, let's say, at this moment of the historical process. And in my opinion, has to do with a huge, unbelievable weakness of the workers' organization.
What, if any, was the effect of looking at what happened in Greece, of Syriza starting with defiance, ending up surrendering to the creditors? Did that have any influence on Portuguese thinking?
Oh, I think so. No doubt. There was a huge expectation. Let's say the average of the population that is on anti-austerity had the expectations in Syriza. And this had a big impact, demoralizing people. But on the other way, why did they expect that would be different in a situation where Syriza was not, in fact, using any of the weapons they have, including the unilateral moratoria over the public debt, to negotiate? So there was a negotiation where the weaker part, didn't use what they have, which is, because of course, if we have to think about this question of the debt, which is the central question of the debt. I mean, Brazil at this moment to open the national conference against the payment in favor of the audit to the debt in Brazil. Also, Brazil is a state that is absolutely now focused on creating superavits to pay the debt. This is what became the economy. And this question, there is never told to the populations of this country that who is in debt has a huge problem, but who gets money also has a huge problem if we have moratorias. So there is no apocalypse when there are moratorias of debt. What there is the increasing of the class struggle. But everybody seems to avoid the idea of a conflict inside the countries. I think this is the main point we have now.
Brazil is a very large country and could have some strength when negotiating with creditors, whereas Greece and Portugal are rather small, and the creditors can easily withstand any threat of default. Does that make a difference in the politics of debt?
To my opinion, no, because I think there are two things very important. First of all, is the economic point. Even a small country can have a huge impact given to the situation of the globalization of the finance sector. So it's not so easy to take out a country of the chain just because the debt corresponds to 2 or 3%. For example, the Greek system, Germany had always said they would stop giving money to the Greeks, but they kept giving it. Because, in my opinion, they know that Greece is the door of the entrance of the German capital in the Balkans and at the beginning of the Middle East, in that area. So all the Greek banks are straightly connected with the Balkan banks. And so this it wouldn't be so easy economically to do this. The second thing is a political thing. How would European workers, working class in a broad sense, either manual or intellectual, how would workers see if the Portugal has a moratoria over the debt? How would the Europeans look to the Portuguese population as a country of an honest people that should deserve a sentence to be left alone, or has brave people that are an example to follow a new European policy? I think there are a lot of trade on the other side of this situation, the political situation. For example, what we saw in the refugees crisis was that the states were obliged to have policies towards the refugees, because suddenly 130 taxis from Vienna went to pick refugees for free. Thousands of Austrians went to the border to pick up refugees. So the answer of the Europe, of the European population, is not clear that will be extreme right answer. I think we are still looking to a continent with a very old class conscience, very progressive, where I wouldn't say socialist conscience, but a very democratic human rights conscience that prevailed over what is clear nowadays for everybody since 2008. The world capitalism system has bankrupt and didn't bankrupt the biggest companies in America, including the Bank of America, General Motors, so the banks in Germany, in England. So the private sector needed huge amount of public money to keep going on. And this is clear for everybody in the world nowadays. But I don't want to look outside of reality. So I believe that all solutions are possible at this moment, but it's not clear for me that a nationalistic, xenophobic solution would prevail in Europe towards the southern country.
And finally, there's an election in Spain in a couple of months. What do you expect out of that? Will that have political importance for the continent?
Well, Spain is more, I would say that the Spanish situation is more critical, not just because it's a bigger country, but because of the divisions over the fraction of the, let's say, bourgeoisie. And this, the biggest impact on this is on the question of on the nationalisms in a Basque country, in Catalonia, above all. So I think the crisis, the economic crisis, has diminished the amount of surplus to divide among the different fractions of the bourgeoisie, and the expression of this is the split, the regional and geographical split inside Spain. So I think this leads, this gives the biggest opportunities to the working classes, because the state is more divided, is less strong to deal with the conflicts. On the second hand, we have the Nós, Cidadãos and Podemos. So we have the, let's say, the end of parliamentary rotativism that was the pattern of the regime in the last three decades. We see this clearly in Spain. But I believe that Podemos is also facing huge problems, not just internal problems connected with the with the eternal question of how to make a democratic organization, but also the question how to face the economic situation, including the debts. So I think all these parties will have their moment of, let's say, there will be a moment where they will have to face reality, objective reality. And the objective reality is that there will be no way to pay salaries and continue to remunerate the capitals that are in the bank system and that are now, of course, supported by the European stabilization money that is mainly German money, of course.
That was Raquel Varela, a labor historian who teaches at the New University of Lisbon. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Continuing the solo flute mode, let's go with this, the conclusion of Bach's Partita, performed by Jean-Pierre Rampal. Till next week, bye.